Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. We're going to be speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law, and today is March 3rd, 2011. We're also going to have Greg Glazer, a specialist in constitutional law, with us the first Thursday of each month. So here we are. It's March, and hopefully we're thinking springtime. I want to thank the hundreds of listeners. We have had hundreds of downloads of our archives of the previous shows, and very fortunate to have enthusiastic people who are interested in learning about these issues of vaccinations, exemptions, waivers, constitutional law and freedom, and are investigating what their rights are. There's quite a few activities going on the internet and in the different states. I know that our guests will be talking about that, and I wanted to say hello to them right now. Alan and Greg, welcome.
Hi, Debbie.
Good morning.
Thank you. Nice to be
Good
here.
Good morning.
Great to have you. I started the chat a little bit late, so if people are wondering how to get on there, it is now open if you've been if you just started listening to the show. Just click the chat, and you're in there. And don't forget, you can favorite this show, you can Twitter it, you can put it on your Facebook and let other people know about this great opportunity, and you can even download the previous archives or put the widget onto your website so people can listen every time that the show goes on. And we have four shows now a week from Homeopathy World Community, Homeopathy Radio. We've got on Monday just studying about the Organon of Medicine and general health news. We also had a special guest, Manfred Mueller, this past Monday talking about toxicity in our environment and how to detox. And then on Wednesday, we've got the Organic Gardening Show. And Thursday is vaccination. And then the brand new show is on Sunday night, which is a late night meditation, because I feel like we're all out there working so hard during the week and giving of ourselves and healing other people, and we need to get something in return. We need to nurture ourselves and get a little downtime. So I just wanted to let people know about that. The other thing is that Alan has a fantastic ebook, and you can go to his website and check that out for any questions that you might have relating to vaccination rights, waivers, and exemptions. I've got a lot of intro today. we have been talking over the past number of Mondays about the law and governmental powers in a republic and whether they can have some sort of forced vaccination or whether they can require you to be quarantined if there's a declaration of martial law, war, an outbreak, or a pandemic. Boy, these are really big terms. Then we looked at the legal analysis of being peacefully natural and what that is, so you can listen to the archives on that terminology. And we were questioning about whether the states are allowed to quarantine for medical reasons through the exercise of police power. Is that what we're going to be talking about today, Greg?
Yeah, today primarily we're going to be talking about the police power, what its origin is, and what it means for your rights. And what it means for the state to be able to use the police power to enforce its health decisions on the public, its public health programs.
Okay. Well, why don't we just go right ahead and begin the discussion about that particular issue. And if you have input, Alan, I'm looking forward to you guiding us through this also.
Sure. And I tell you, I would start, Greg, and good morning to you, by the way, Greg and Debbie.
Hey, good morning.
Just real delighted to have you back again, Greg. I would start with just sort of the kind of the basic fundamental question that comes to my mind is, could you talk to us a little bit, Greg, about what is police power? What does that term mean? Where does it come from? Where do states get that from? What does it encompass? Because it's such a fundamental part of this whole topic. It is it not? What the states can or can't do, and under what situation and circumstances, and then of course the tension there, especially for those of us with a view on vaccines, which is still currently an alternative view, who gets to decide, and where are those lines, and maybe those lines have shifted over time or not, but and I think from, you know, having looked at your memorandum previously, this all goes to the heart of definitions. You know, what is a republic, and when, if a state exercises its authority beyond a certain point, are we still a republic? Those kinds of things. So what is the police power, Greg, and where does that come from?
Yeah. The police power is an overarching term. It's like an overarching method of authority. So it's the reason why the police have any power at all. But the Supreme Court has said that it's a term that also cannot be easily defined, because it springs from the right of the police and the duty of the police to protect the public, to promote the public health, the public safety. At one point, it was defined to include public morals, but then they said, oh, well, you know, the police can't be enforcing a moral code. And so it has a certain ebb and flow throughout history. And its origin actually goes back to early civilization, very, very distant to America. And it came from basically tribal communities. They were policing themselves. And then over time they thought, well, it's more efficient to give our authority, you know, to this one guy, you know, or these couple guys who are really better cops than the rest of us. So they gave the right to police the society. And then, and you know, those traditional laws were based on religion or morals or just, you know, efficiency. And then as time went on and laws became more complex, you had the origin of the modern police structures, you know, your classic sheriff, your classic law enforcement bodies. And these police were still given their authority from the people. So the origin of the police power doctrine actually comes from the right of self-defense, the right of the individual to protect himself from the rest of society. So it's a doctrine rooted in fairness. And again, as the United States Supreme Court said, it can't be easily defined. I'll give you a quote right here from the Supreme Court. The police power, that inherent and necessary power, essential to the very existence of civil society, and the safeguard of the inhabitants of the state against disorder, disease, poverty, and crime. And also, very important to our topic today, the police power has been used as the authority for public health programs. And so, for example, the police power was used in the early 1800s on the East Coast to implement programs to quarantine people and issue remedies against yellow fever. And it was well recognized that this was part of the power that the government has to protect the public health. And these laws are very, very infrequently challenged throughout history because it was seen as a traditional goal of the state. So hopefully that's a nice overview to get us started.
Yeah, so yeah. It seems to me then that would stem originally, perhaps, and most fundamentally from a right to self-defense, and that certainly as a society we collectively want to defend ourselves, and that includes then defense against infectious disease or spread of infectious disease. And so while we don't typically think day-to-day of police as having anything to do with healthcare or in a typical day-to-day sense, it certainly makes perfect sense on a concept level that if we as a society are going to assign a policing role to certain individuals or departments or agencies or what have you, that would incorporate that. Of course, you know, then the questions that have come more to the forefront, perhaps during and since the recent swine flu pandemic, on many people's minds, especially those who have, again, the alternative view on vaccines, is that there is police power. Most states have authority to mandate vaccines in a declared emergency and to a large extent throw exemptions out the window, in particular philosophical and religious exemptions. That is, we enjoy those rights in one or both of those in most states, but they can go away in a declared emergency. And so where's the step from there then with that basic right to defend ourselves? But who gets to decide where to draw those lines? Who gets to decide whether someone, a person or group of people needs to be quarantined, or that a group of people in a particular emergency situation have to get a vaccine?
Currently the law is written to vest that authority with the agencies of the executive arm of the government. So that's going to be your Department of Health and Human Services, for example, or it's going to be like a FEMA, Department of Homeland Security.
Now, I saw a lot of confusion during the pandemic itself as it played out, and perhaps to a somewhat lesser degree since, where people seem to be confused about what level of government had authority in what situation. And by levels, I mean we have local authorities, individual county health departments or equivalent, probably throughout the country here in the U.S. And then we have, of course, state authority. We have actually a separate tribal authority for Native Americans. And then, of course, we have federal authorities, and then the World Health Organization has some authority as well. And I thought if I may jump in here briefly, Greg, and just mention an example the CDC uses on their page, because I thought it was a real good example. A main part of the confusion I saw is a lot of people were afraid the World Health Organization was going to mandate vaccines for everyone. And there may not be crystal clear lines in an absolute sense about who has authority in what situation, but I was concerned when I saw that going around the alternative vaccine communities, because my understanding is that, at least as a starting point in the analysis, that there are fairly clear lines of authority. And, for example, the reason that most vaccine laws are at the state level is because the federal government doesn't have authority to mandate vaccines for state residents. Health in our society traditionally has been, and perhaps not exclusively, but to a large extent has been a state law level issue. But where you have a concern of the spread of disease between states, or you potentially involve the federal government there, or between countries, you involve the World Health Organization there. But the example that the CDC gave on their website, which I thought was great, they talk about a potential infectious disease emergency occurring at an international airport. That would, of course, have immediately implication for local authorities in whatever state that were to occur in, but potentially as well state authorities and national and international authorities if it's an international airport. So there could be situations where you have concurrent jurisdiction or overlapping jurisdiction in these issues. So it sort of potentially muddies the question about who gets to decide what and when and how. But I think it's interesting, and one other quick example, that I saw at least one instance during the pandemic where a local county declared a swine flu emergency in their county. We saw, of course, 11 states declaring swine flu emergencies. We had our own federal government declaring a national emergency, and we had, of course, the World Health Organization declaring a level 6 pandemic. So all these different levels can be involved. But generally, I don't think you're going to have this concurrent jurisdiction situation. I think the authority that most of us in the U.S. are concerned with in most situations is at the state or local level, and what the local level could do is probably based on state law as well. Would you agree with that, Greg?
Yeah, I would. Traditionally, you're right, that local law enforcement and local authorities are the ones who administer these local health programs, including vaccination. The way that sort of this has been evolving in the last 10 years in particular is that they're forging these partnerships with the state level and then at the federal level, where they're taking their orders from the top. So they'll make their programs, their local programs, harmonize with the federal programs, with the federal standards. So it sort of depends on what the nature of the emergency is, you know? I mean, if they can get the whole nation to declare a swine flu emergency, then all of your local programs will fall in line with the federal standards.
And that's a really good...
Like, if they had
go ahead.
Attack,
yeah,
you know?
It seems like last year was like a dry run for what could potentially happen, and that we're sorting it out. That you listed all of the levels of hierarchy where something could be affected, whether it would be the international level at the WHO, the federal national emergency system, the state emergency system, and then even the local level. And how, and you're kind of giving this picture of harmonizing that, who is going to take the authority or the stance, and then who is going to just copy it or utilize it? Will it start from the bottom up or from the top down? And who benefits? What is the reason why someone, which of these parts of government would take a stand to whether quarantine or have a forced vaccination program or whatever the requirements might be? And I also had one more question, Alan. You said that on the internet and some of those websites, they had discussions about something, and I didn't understand exactly where they got the notion of what could happen. You know, where do they get their information from?
Well,
that's a lot of questions.
Yeah, let me jump in quick for a couple points there, and then I'll turn it back over to Greg, because we want to get as much from Greg while he's here only once a month with us as we can. But I don't know is the short answer to where people get the information. But what I observe is that it appears a lot of times people make assumptions about constitutional rights or World Health Organization authority or other related issues, and it's a little bit scary or a bit of a concern to me when I see that as an attorney, because a lot of us would probably agree that our rights should be this, that, or the other, but that may or may not, in fact, be what our rights actually are. And I find myself sometimes at odds with my peers in the vaccine arena, where I'm trying as carefully as I can to explain from my point of view of how the law works, which may be something entirely different from what I personally want or would prefer. It's really critical for us to distinguish between what the law actually is, what our rights actually are, and to what extent they may or may not even be defined on any given point in any given situation, and what we would like our rights to be. Because until we have that kind of clarification, we don't know really exactly it is what we're fighting for or against if we want things to be different than what they are. So it's really, really critical there.
Yeah, we have to be careful about misinformation getting spread around.
But I also wanted to say underscore the fact that I said as a starting point, there may be fairly clear lines on jurisdiction. And Greg raises a really good point there. I have somewhat joked at times about how North Carolina, and I'm sure many other states, defer quite frequently to federal law, and in health, particularly to the CDC. That's probably a common phenomenon. I was had the great pleasure a few days ago speaking with the Director of Public Health here in North Carolina, and in the conversation, the question came up of where are the philosophical exemptions. And while only a generalization, I said, well, most of the philosophical exemptions are east of the, I mean, are west of the Mississippi. Most of the states east of the Mississippi only have the religious and medical. And there was a quiet chuckle in the room. States seem to have, and this is a broad generalization, and Greg, I'd absolutely welcome your correction or input on this, but my impression is that states, in one sense, can kind of fall, with regard to their relationship to the federal government, can fall into sort of two categories. And one category is sort of like the rebellious teenager, don't tell me what to do. And that seems to be more common out west, where there seems to be more importance on state autonomy and as being separate and independent of the federal government, whereas the states, and again, broad generalization, some of the states in the east tend more to be the teacher's pet kind of mentality of if the federal government says so, they'll get on board and get in line with it. And so, but
what
in any event...
What happened to Don't Tread on Me?
Well, it's an interesting point, and I'm sure we can elaborate on this hopefully at length over the hour and shows to come with Greg about, you know, what are some of the implications of authority being weighted or not at the federal or state level, because Greg's point is quite valid and important one, that even if technically states have autonomy on a certain point or they're the ones that make the decision, when it comes to health matters, they often will get in line to a very high degree with whatever the federal authorities are recommending. So different states have different vaccine laws, for example. They're not all identical, but they're all generally similar. And if the CDC recommends it, there's a pretty good chance, at least historically, I think this has been the case, that the states will enact the recommendation. The federal government can't, you know, the CDC can't mandate vaccines, but they can recommend it. And when Obama declared a swine flu emergency, that did not give the federal government authority to mandate vaccines for state residents, maybe for the military as a federal agency and other federal agencies, but not for state residents. But it set up nonetheless a precedent, in using that word in kind of an informal sense as opposed to the more strict legal sense of the word. It's kind of set a precedent that may have made it easier or invited states to declare state emergencies. And when the states declare a state emergency, that's when the state then gives itself permission, in effect, if it chooses, to mandate vaccines or implement quarantines and so forth. And so, and we did see New York for a short period of time did mandate swine flu vaccines for healthcare employees. And I agree with you, Debbie, if I understood correctly. I think this swine flu pandemic this time around was a dry run on a lot of levels to see what would happen, how people would react to it, not to mention how much money you can make off of vaccines if you just get them to call it a level six, even though it really isn't a level six.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. I mean, you know, they call it H1N1, and then they'll call the next one H5N1, and you say, oh, my gosh, it must be that much worse.
H7N1. Oh, four times as bad.
We're H1N2 right now. So we're just going to, it's sort of like
about
we're just going to, Microsoft is going to put out a new virus. Who knows? Okay, so
there was one point I wanted to raise about preemption, the difference between federal and state authority. The United States Supreme Court held in the case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts in 1905 that the states and not federal government have jurisdiction over issues of vaccination. So that was very clear. And that was a holding, actually, that just kind of extended an earlier case called Morgan Steamship from 1886. But the change today is that there is an exclusive domain of federal authority when it comes to issues of terrorism. And so if there is some inclination that the source of the threat, the source of the health threat, is of an international character or of a terrorist character, bam, federal authority.
Bam, huh?
Yeah. And so
my gosh.
Federal preemption is seen as like a bellwether for the federal government taking control over a particular area. And so generally the states maintained a lot of power when they had the infrastructure and the funding to be able to, you know, finance their own operations. But that's changed, and that game has changed in the last 30 years because states have become beholden to the federal government for their funding. And this is,
yes.
And so states, you know, they kind of lost their backbone over the last 30 years, and now you have a system that has is already geared toward centralized federal authority.
So the federal government then, over the course of these last three decades, has found a way, despite the technicality that they don't have authority or don't have absolute authority or direct control, the practical reality is to the extent they're holding the purse strings, they really do have control. And I have sort of generalized that myself when talking to folks to say the bottom line is states, if they want those federal – the federal government, maybe they can't say you have to do this, you know, with regard to any of a number of specific issues, but what they can say is we'll give you dollars if you do it our way. And so practically speaking, there might not be a whole lot of difference there. And it's a real interesting point you make, Greg, the extent to which states have become dependent on federal dollars, then they are, in effect, they are subject to meeting the federal government's requirements to get those dollars. And therefore, even if the state ultimately, in a technical sense, holds the authority, in a practical sense, it's been whittled away at over the last many years on that. Am I saying that correctly? Is that fit?
Yeah. That's how it's played out.
Boy.
Well, it seems like when you started, I had in my mind this idea how we have given to. I'm kind of moving from the idea of authority that we send our kids to school. And over the course of time, we have given a lot of authority to teach for the teachers and the administration of the schools to teach our children not just reading, writing, arithmetic, and arts and all of those things, but also moral and ethical values, how to be a good citizen and things like that. And in a way, that is like a little microcosm of what happens in the world. And so, again, by, you said, giving deference to the greater authority or the larger body of the federal or international body that mandates laws or regulations, that if we, again, give up our individual power as parents, as regular citizens, to these greater authorities because, let's say, we just want somebody else to handle it. We don't want to think about it or we don't want to take the responsibility. It's very involved kind of a relationship between these different parts of government and the people.
Well, it's just as a purely practical matter. I mean, who has the time to keep up with all the things that ideally we'd want to keep up with and still have a job and a life and a family? I mean, I don't, and probably few, if any of any of us do. So, you know, on just at least a superficial level, it makes absolute sense to delegate authority. And gosh, if you can put decision-making power in one place instead of having all 50 states have to do it independently, look at all the time you're going to save. The problem, of course, is that human nature is such that, given an opportunity to manipulate and control others, there are some of us who will fight tooth and nail to grab that power and exercise it in a non-objective way. And so, you know, I don't know if in a theoretical sense this is a balancing act or if it really we just need to, in an ideal society, just really minimize as much as possible centralization of power so that we avoid there even being something there for people to get a hold of and take over and take advantage of in inappropriate ways. But what we find when we look closely at the CDC and other federal agencies, and I expect to one degree or another in state agencies as well, is conflict of interest and sometimes outright corruption. And so I have argued recently that in particular in arguing for in support of a philosophical exemption in New Hampshire, which they're trying to get through up there now, states need to understand that there are these conflicts of interest and that we can no longer as a society afford to just simply defer to a recommendation from a federal authority. As convenient and cost-effective as that might be at times, the practical result is that we allow, and when we do that, we allow special interests to dictate policy and law. And when you do that in health, people's lives suffer or even lost as a consequence. And so we can't do that anymore.
I love that answer, Alan. I really did. That was so well said. We do need to be an educated population and understand when we give up some authority or some power from an individual that somebody else is going to take it over and do whatever. You know, you have to have a relationship of trust. Did we get all the way off of our topic? We're talking about vaccines and quarantine history and martial law history and what happens when we reboot the system, I guess.
And Greg Glaser, by the way, he has, we've referred to throughout this series and will continue to, a memo that he has written on this subject. It's available on the Pandemic Response Project website. That's at pandemicresponseproject.com. It's linked right on the homepage, folks. Get a copy, download this memo, and read through it. Give yourself plenty of time. There's a lot. Greg has done just an amazing job and had to have spent hundreds of hours researching this. It's the most thoughtful treatment of this issue that I've ever seen, and he's just done an excellent job, and it's given us and will continue to give us much to talk about. And let's go forward. Where are we now here at this point?
Greg, we're going to let you sort it all out and focus us in the right direction.
Yeah. I appreciate the comments about the memo too. I'm glad that it's helpful for people. You know, it asks the question of, can the government forcefully vaccinate you in the event of martial law, war outbreak, pandemic, whatever they want to call it? Even if they called it FLIRG, could they forcefully vaccinate you? And the answer is that if you are a peacefully natural person, you should be in the clear. And it's difficult to achieve that status because the average person, you know, lives in a community where they don't have like a lot of private acreage where they can kind of set themselves away from the community and self quarantine, and so there's a doctrine called the social contract, which is like, you know, you take on the responsibilities of the community in which you live. So, you know, the law in itself kind of changes from area to area based on what is reasonable within the community. And so the first thing that we were talking about was the police power. And, you know, the police have this power to implement their public health programs, and they can issue these orders of vaccination for people who are, you know, within community areas. But if you can set yourself outside of that area and self-quarantine yourself, then you should have this right to be peacefully natural on private property and self-quarantine yourself. So that's a fundamental safeguard that should exist in the law. Now, whether or not one has that ability to get to that point and exercise that right, that is an untested question, because, you know, the next round of bioterrorism from whatever source derived is going to put that to the test.
And I want to clarify for our listeners, Greg, what you mean by test, as I understand it, and by all means, of course, clarify further as needed. There are many, many issues. Law, in one sense, sets out to do something that, at least in the absolute sense, is fundamentally flawed or impossible in the first place, and that is it proposes to put out a set of rules that would, at least ideally, apply to the full range of hypothetical future fact scenarios. And, of course, that's just not something that's practically feasible. And so there are many issues that our law doesn't necessarily address specifically or clearly, and that's just inherent in the system. There's nothing wrong with that per se. It's an unavoidable byproduct of the system, the way it's set up, and the reality that we live in. The result is that from time to time we'll have issues or disputes that become formal in the sense that they become a court case, and judges are from time to time faced with issues that have never been come before the court before, or have never at least reached a level where they became legal precedent. Because when you don't, when you're not sure how a law applies, you look to legal precedent to guide you. And sometimes courts have what they call a case of first impression, meaning there isn't any legal precedent, and the court has to figure out what to do with that. So you have a situation that hasn't ever come before the court. The courts, you may not know, we may not be able to say with any specificity or precision what the law really is on that point. And I think that's what Greg is saying here. And I'll give an example. Again, I refer to when I was speaking with the North Carolina Public Health Director, we told them, among other things, that we would like to have enacted into North Carolina law the right for people to do quarantines in their home. The way the law is currently worded leaves open the possibility that health authorities, and just a real quick clarification, the police would not be actually issuing the orders. They would be issued by some the governor or some delegated authority, which would be health authorities of one kind or another, state or local health directors and that sort of thing. But police could certainly be employed to enforce those orders, especially were somebody to be resisting them. And by all means, Greg, you know, anytime I make assertions, if they're incomplete or incorrect, by all means, you know, jump in with them. But anyway, it was real interesting. The wording of the law here in North Carolina leaves open the possibility, very clearly as I read it, that the health authorities can decide where quarantines take place. And I can imagine an instance of bioterrorism, which could be something that happens abruptly, some sort of bioweapon that explodes or otherwise disseminates a biological agent rapidly. And maybe there'd be a situation where the state would want people who are in their office building downtown to stay in their office building. We didn't reach this level of the discussion with the state health director, but I can envision scenarios where having just a general law that says, you know, if you're ordered to quarantine, you can do that in your home. Maybe you don't want somebody to go home because they're going to be exposed by doing that. So it's a complex issue when you add this idea of bioterrorism to historical common law dealing with infectious disease in of a natural origin. So it is tricky, but the response from the state health director, and I would expect this to be a response probably in most, if not all, other states, something very similar, was we have a policy, and this is actually written into the law, where they have to use the least restrictive means. And so they weren't going to budge on their authority. They weren't going to surrender any authority willingly to put limits on where they can tell people to do quarantines. So I've kind of argued both sides a little bit here, you know, because we went in there wanting the right to quarantine in our home, but I can envision a situation where that might be not effective. As long as the state's policy and the law says they have to use the least restrictive means, on the surface, that seems all well and good. The problem, of course, as we've seen at various levels of government, is that authority can be misused or abused, that people can have in positions of authority can have conflicts of interest and in some cases outright corruption. And so the issue is not quite as simple as what makes sense in a scientific or epidemiological sense. It's more complex than that. The question is, who are the people making the decisions? Do they have conflicts of interest or other inappropriate influences or biases? And what are the
in here with a little bit of an answer on this too? Question is can we self quarantine in our homes? And the answer will depend first on, well, what is the threat? Is it an airborne threat? Can you urinate it into the public water supply? And then second, what is your home? Is it an apartment building? Is it a, you know, is it on a little suburban home on a quarter acre? Is it on an acre? And then the third question is, what does the regulatory authority say to the on the first two questions? And then lastly, you apply the Fourth Amendment, which is you have the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures and to be secure in your person's papers and effects. in your home. And so in answering those questions, you're going to come with a legal outcome. And the law will look at each person individually, or it's supposed to at least. But in the event that you have a state of martial law, by definition, martial law exists when courts aren't working. That's the only time it exists. And so you're going to have military tribunals which will decide these answers. And I'll tell you, they're going to defer to the judgment of the public health authorities. So you're kind of at the whim on this question, can you self-quarantine in your home? You're kind of at the whim of, well, whatever the military says.
So right now you're telling us we have no answer to that question, that it is up to the state authority or the national authority, or we are still in the middle of sorting it all out because we don't have enough information. This is a very important point that probably people want to know the answer. If something happens, if something is declared, and they decide it at the local government, the state government, or the federal government that quarantine is a must because there is an outbreak of some kind, then will people run, you know, like Hurricane Hugo? I mean, you just run into your house and you shut everything down and you don't go out because there's too much danger out there. What is it, to kind of make it as clear to listening audience as possible?
Sure. I mean, we have some historical precedent on this, and the precedent is in favor of the government. Smith v. Turner, 1849, police power used to control the threat of yellow fever. Reynolds v. McNichols, Colorado, upholding health hold orders to close down a bathhouse. Juho v. Williamson, 1900, quarantine of San Francisco district inhabited primarily by Chinese immigrants, purportedly to control the spread of bubonic plague. So, of course, you have all of the other quarantine orders from the old mercantile ship days. The answer is that when the public gets scared of an outbreak, then they quarantine, and the public goes. It's part of, I guess you could say, like, fearful human nature, is that the pack sort of gathers together and then, you know, decides what it feels is in the best interest of the pack, just based on fear. Now, that's not always the case. I mean, you have many outliers. Like, there was a case of when they tried to do that in New York City I think it was like pre-1850. And a bunch of the residents of New York fled to the mountains of New York. They said, you know, forget this. I'm not quarantining myself in my local area. I'm going to go up to my mountain retreat. And so it made enforcement of the quarantine order very challenging to local authorities. But, you know, local authorities, they're not trying to hit 100% on the mark. They're just trying to get, you know, as many people on board as they can. And so I think that is probably what you would have in the event of martial law order today.
Well, that's an interesting
point.
The
people who have the mountain retreat, they're going to be okay. They're going to be having a good time fishing.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, when I was told you don't need to worry about the right to quarantine in your home because we're going to use the least restrictive means, and it occurred to me, well, if we had something that was so severe or progressed to a point to where they were trying to do mass quarantines, there would not be the forces available to police that in any absolute sense anyway. But, you know, so I'm not sure on a practical level, while in a conceptual level, my goal makes perfect sense to me that we should have more control to choose a location for quarantine than it feels like we have, at least in terms of what the law says. I'm not sure on a practical level where we get to with
right.
that. But Greg, I wanted to ask you a question.
We have some comments in the chat room here.
Let's go with those.
Okay, let's see. We have Dr. Bob. He says, it seems like the laws are arbitrary and capricious, that ignorant people can order ignorant people whatever you want to do with them. And have we ever declared martial law in the United States during the past 100 years? That was a historical question.
Do you know the answer to that, Greg? I don't.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Martial law was declared in 1812 by General Andrew Jackson in New Orleans, declared in 1892 in Idaho after some rebellious mine workers blew up a mill. In 1914, coal field wars in Colorado, 1934. So, I mean, you're starting to see the point here. I mean, it comes up every now and then. Usually it's in isolated circumstances. After the San Francisco earthquake had happened in Hawaii in 1941. At the time, Hawaii wasn't a state. Just got to keep that in mind.
Okay.
Whiskey Rebellion, you know. I mean, you know, so it comes up. The only time that it was declared in a major sense, though, like across the nation, was when Lincoln did it for the Civil War. And eventually the court overruled him. They said, you know, because the courts were working. So they said, you know, you can't declare martial law across an entire nation. The courts are working. What's the point?
Yeah. But the difference is today the executive branch has all the power.
That's kind of generalization. No. We're still a law of law. In order.
Okay. I'll give you that.
it's just the interests are so integrated that it's hard sometimes to see the separation between the powers that be. But you know, I think that there are some serious distinctions that play out their hand, especially when it comes to like political issues. I'd like to see this rule on martial law being strictly upheld, and so that, you know, the precedent that was set that overruled Lincoln would also apply today to overrule President Obama in the event that he declared martial law over the entire nation. Because if the courts are working, then that's our recourse. Personally, let's take a hypothetical here. Okay, let's say that there is a bioterror attack, and it hits the western United States, and it hits water. And President Obama issues a declaration of martial law over the entire United States. And then the CDC issues these widespread regulations across quarantining people and apportioning resources and everything. And then they have this vaccine that they want to give out too, just to limit the threat of disease. And they say, okay, well, we're going to make it mandatory. And now here I am. I'm on my land, I have 15 acres, and I'm trying to, you know, avoid this vaccine and just kind of quarantine myself on a personal level. But lo and behold, you know, I go for like 6 months, and let's say I go for like a month, and everything's fine, they haven't got to me yet. And the car comes up, throws me in the back, and takes me to a facility. Say, hey, look, you know, you violated the order, this is a military order, and then I say, look, I'm not a threat. You know, I have my own water supply, you know, yada, yada, yada. And they say, sorry, look, you're out of luck. And then they put me in this camp. It's like a concentration camp. Now, what do I do? What's my remedy? And what I would do in that instance is I would look at any governing documents that were used to put me in this little camp. You know, if they have like an order or something like that, and I would try to appeal it. And if I can't appeal it, then what I do is I or my wife, anyone who can file it on my behalf, because, again, I'm in this camp, I can't really file court papers, has to go down to the courthouse, if the courthouse is functioning, and file a writ of habeas corpus, or technically it's an application for a writ of habeas corpus. And habeas corpus is Latin for they have the body. It's a traditional motion, or it's like a piece of paper that you file that says, set me free. You know, I'm in the right here, and the government's in the wrong, and I need my freedom. And it's one of these documents that is so simple, it can even be handwritten. All you have to do is write, you know, this is an application for a writ of habeas corpus. And you say, what happened? And then the procedure is that, and you can take this to state court or to federal court, kind of depends on which court issued the order that, you know, governing your incarceration. And then after you file your application for a writ, the writ is actually issued by the clerk to the sheriff or to whoever's holding you to, and they say, this person, Greg Glazer, has requested his freedom. you now have to justify why you're holding him. And then they have usually it's like 15 days to reply, or if they don't reply, then it's automatically deemed that they are rejecting all of your points. And then the court in which this document is filed can either issue a hearing or request evidence or just decide on the writ. And that is how the writ of habeas corpus works. Was that helpful?
Oh, extremely helpful. It's something that I'm unfamiliar with, and I'm sure our listeners as well.
I think it's great because, you know, it's good to put out that hypothetical scenario so people have a visualization of what you're really talking about, what you in the future, what you foresee is actually even possible. Alan, you were talking about the dynamic way that laws work to be able to handle whatever is going to come up that has not happened before. So in a way, by providing these hypothetical scenarios, people have a more tangible idea of how the law works and what they can do, what actions and steps they can do to protect themselves. So I like that. If you have more of those, that's great.
Yeah, and let me, if I may, jump in with a quick point here, that there's a tendency sometimes when people see a problem, a misuse or abuse of authority, to reject authority altogether. I have to say that I think that there absolutely could be and can be situations where quarantine would be absolutely appropriate, where maybe even, God forbid, that martial law would be appropriate. The question for me is not so much whether we should have the right as a society to protect ourselves collectively with these measures, nearly so much as it is who gets to decide when those measures are appropriate and what's the basis for those decisions, and can those decisions be made in inappropriate ways? And at the risk of being redundant here, there's some very compelling evidence now that there was no true level 6 swine flu pandemic. The definition was changed by the World Health Organization so that they could call a mild disease level 6 that would not have met the prior definition, and to suggest that they did that for the purpose of, at least in part, or let's just say as a consequence of that, that $18 billion worth of vaccines were sold because you have a level 6 declaration, it triggered contract provisions between countries around the world and the pharmaceutical industry for the production and purchase of swine flu vaccines to the tune of about $18 billion, according to one credible source. And following that, we had a national emergency declared and 11 states declared emergencies, Washington, D.C., et cetera, and probably other countries around the world. And those declarations have real-world consequences, whether the declaration is valid or not. And so there, you know, should we have a mechanism in place that can protect us from potentially harmful or lethal infectious disease outbreak? We probably should. Should that be run in a way where somebody can change definitions and generate profits and it turns out, oops, there wasn't a serious problem after all? You know, how we balance the need to protect ourselves and the means by which we achieve that is a tough question.
We only have a few minutes left today in the show, and I would like to make a little small comment to what you just proposed there, Alan, with the way that I call it mass hysteria, and call it initiating this fear and hyped up thinking. If people would be able to feel calm about things, I don't think that the mass hysteria would run out of control like that, and they would be thinking more clearly about what is actually true and happening and what is propaganda or being told to them to move them in a certain direction and tell them to just go get your flu vaccine or this and this is happening. I mean, we need, even though it's important to act quickly and rapidly in a true emergency, I think that very often things get out of hand just because of mass hysteria. And so I think that the people need to be a little calmer.
Yeah.
Well, yes, and that raises a real critical question about what causes the mass hysteria. You know, to what extent is any part of that legitimate to the situation versus something that is fueled for a not fully legitimate or appropriate purpose?
Yeah.
Greg, jump in here.
Yeah. My thought is that when mass hysteria takes root, it is hard to put out, and that society is mass society based on the mainstream media's push is very dangerous. And people don't always act rationally, and it seems to me that the writing is sort of on the wall right now. I mean, look at the world around us. You know, it's very polluted, it's militarily driven. We talked about the pharmaceutical complex. That's the majority. Majority eats Burger King burgers. You know, this is dangerous. That's what I mean by the writing is on the wall. So, like, I mean, sure. You know, personally, individually, we can rise above the mass hysteria. But that's personally, individually. I really do think the writing is on the wall, people, that the
stop eating those burgers
are going to clamp down. The next round of bioterrorism or terrorism, when it comes, it's going to be sweeping. And so if you can, try to find yourself in a situation that I'm describing here. Be able to quarantine yourself on private acreage, provide for your own needs, and it's going to serve you the best opportunity. And then I have a little insight, actually, because over the last 10 days, I got really sick, and I don't usually get sick, and it was it was a real life experience for me. And over the whole time, I was thinking, gosh, where's the lesson here? What am I going to learn here? And it finally hit me 2 days ago that the lesson is that the body will kick its own butt to try to get back to normal. And the state of normal, the state of natural, is something to be desired. So, you know, if you have an alcohol problem or a drug problem or something like that, keep in mind, you know, how hard your body will fight just to get back to normal, and what a blessing it is to have naturalism in and of itself.
Beautiful.
Amen.
Beautiful. You really have taught us something here. We have 1 minute, so I'm just going to thank you both so much. Awesome show. Learned a lot. We're going to keep going every first Thursday of each month. I keep getting my days mixed up. And I want to thank you, Greg Glazer, constitutional law expert, Alan Phillips, vaccination, exemption, and waivers expert, and you can get in touch with them just by contacting the Blog Talk Radio Homeopathy World Community website and sending us a message. Don't forget to favorite the show. And we're going to say goodbye now and sign off today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
allow our souls to shine. Reaching for the grace of love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be your throne. What I want, we are changing the world. Your truth be young girl.